The speech in your program is entitled High Mightinesses, the States General. And that's not an English word, mightinesses, but that's the closest I could come to the description that the members of the States General gave to themselves. They were the High Mightinesses in the Dutch. That's fairly close to what they call themselves. And the speech, that this brief one, is about the role that the States General had in connection with the Senate of Dort. This is a painting of about 1650 of the States General working together. So it's about 40 years after the Senate of Dort. And the States General's impact on the Senate was tremendous. I cannot overstate it. They would authorize it. They would set the location. They would give the finances. They would determine the delegates, at least who would be invited from what countries, the agenda, who would vote and how, the seating arrangements at the Senate of Dort, the method of writing the canons, and the printing of the acts were all under the supervision of the States General. Very important body. Let's talk about them. First of all, how did the United Netherlands come to be? In the 1314 and 1500s, the lowlands politically was about 17 fiercely independent provinces. They were prosperous. They had a good-sized middle class in the Netherlands, port cities so that they could carry on trade with the world, and they did. It was a fairly developed area with about 3 million people in it by the end of the 1500s. And there were many schools. There was an emphasis in the Netherlands on education. In comparison to the rest of Europe, the Netherlands was a more educated people, which explains something of how they could print so many pamphlets and so many people would buy them because they could read the pamphlets during the time of the Reformation. The provinces, however, were taken over. In the 15th century, the Dukes of Burgundy encroached on the provinces, especially the southern ones, and eventually through marriage and so on, the lowlands came under the domination of Spain through various marriages where they would give lands as a dowry, so to speak. The Spanish rule then was over this area under Emperor Charles V, who was also the King of Spain, but a very loose control because he relied on this area for revenue. He wanted them to make a lot of money so they could pay taxes. And persecution nonetheless began in 1520 under him when the Reformation began to grow in the Netherlands. And he used also the Inquisition at times, fierce, horrible torture against the people to try to get rid of any trace of the Reformation. The local officials resented that use of the Inquisition against the Dutch people, and they refused to cooperate. Charles abdicated in 55-56, and his son Philip II took the throne, and the persecution then intensified. And eventually this would lead to the Dutch revolting from the rule of Spain. We talked about William of Orange, how he became the leader of the army. The northern provinces banded together against Spain. The southern provinces were quite under the control of Spain. And eventually, seven provinces united to call themselves the United Netherlands. Groningen and Friesland, Overijssel, Gelderland, Utrecht, and Holland, which is the very large province that stretches along the coast, and Zeeland at the bottom. We talked about the 12-year truce that the Netherlands provinces signed with Spain from 609, 12 years they had a truce with Spain, and that of course enabled them to deal with the internal struggles of Arminianism. It is interesting that province, the Holland province, the largest province, politically supported the Remonstrants. There were many, many Reformed preachers in Holland. There were also a number of Remonstrant preachers, and they were defended and upheld by the authorities in Holland. So as we're trying to get a synod, one of the big problems is that Holland didn't want to go along with a synod that would deal with the Arminian controversy. That was huge in all of the political things that were happening. Church and state really became a state over the church. They were forged together, the church and state, in their struggle to throw off Spanish rule and Roman Catholicism. So church and state are of one mind here to have freedom from this control. Local magistrates then eventually controlled the church building, the calling and the paying of the pastor, and even we said earlier, also the support of the poor. Only a states general, only that body of the representatives of those various provinces, only the states general would be allowed to call a national synod. Early on in their history, they had a rule. Any motion passed at the states general, where each province had one vote, had to be unanimous. Now, as they went through time, they recognized we can't do that. It has to be majority. But nonetheless, if Holland was against it, if the province of Holland was against something, it was extremely difficult to go forward with any motion that was passed. The political struggle continues then, and it took a direct turn when Prince Maurice, the stadtholder of Holland and a number of other provinces, a very important position, threw his support to the reformed people, the counter-remonstrants. His military and political actions led to a situation where the States General called for a national synod to be held. The preparations then, the States General made preparations for the great synod. They set the place, Dordrecht. That's where Dordrecht is found. They determined whom to invite. Delegates, they said, from 10 provincial synods should come to the synod, as well as a group of professors, one from each one of the major theological universities. Foreign delegates would be invited from England and France, from reformed regions of Germany and the cities of Switzerland. The churches didn't decide that. The States General decided who would come. Who pays for it? The 10 provincial synods needed to pay for their own delegates' expenses, but the States General would pay for the foreign delegations. And immediately they said, we need 100,000 guilders to begin to support the foreign delegates who would be coming. It was an extremely expensive thing, and they had no idea it was going to go on for over 6 months. Who supervises it? Well, they appointed synodical deputies that would come out of the various provinces and be approved by the States General as their representatives, 18 men of all. Their duty would be, first of all, to maintain this principle. The National Synod, this is, held under the authority of their high mightinesses, the States General. Don't forget who has the authority here. They would open the meeting of Synod and welcome the delegates. They would receive and examine the letters of the foreign delegates. They would ensure that absolutely no political discussions were raised at the Synod. And they would watch the finances. And there's a lot of things in the minutes where the state's deputies, these deputies, synodical deputies, were saying, could we move things along a little bit here? Costs are going up. According to the States General, this was what part of the instruction given to the synodical deputies to behave themselves in such a way that they might tend to the good, to the peace and unity of the churches and communities of these provinces, and shall moreover do whatever may tend to promote the interests of the reformed Christian religion. This is the national government giving that instruction to their deputies. This was a unique time in the history of the world. Who will vote? They said all the invited delegates will vote, also the foreign delegates. There's a question. If we invite these foreign delegates, will they only be able to talk? No, they will be able to vote, said the States General. Each group will have one collective vote, 10 provincial synods. The professors would have their own vote, one for the professors total, and then each foreign delegation, one vote each. Who sits where? Now, that isn't quite as big a deal for us, is it? Who sits where? But in that day, that was important. How important are you? It will be determined by where you sit. So They had to decide that. This is a touchy political question. Who will have preeminence, France or England? It was carefully determined who would sit where in the assembly. So let me tell you where they sat. The president and the clerk sat in the front table, and the synodical deputies sat right there. So those are the 18 men representing the national government. They sat through every session of synod. On the other side, the place of prominence was given to the English delegates. And that became fairly easy because the French couldn't come. So the French seats were open right next to the English, kept open as a sign of honor to them, even though their delegation was not allowed to come to the synod. The remonstrants sat in the middle table. They were being examined. Then you have the professors, one row there, and other foreign delegates on the other side, and the remaining positions were taken by the Dutch delegates from the various provincial synods. That's where they had to sit, according to the decision of the States General. The States General, how were the canons composed? Well, we pointed out earlier that Bogerman had made an effort. He had written a good deal in refutation of the remonstrance, and the first head pretty much went his way, but some of the foreign delegates didn't like it, and the synodical deputies then got in the act and said, no, we're not going to do it that way. We're going to have a committee that is formed to draft the canons. That was their decision. What is in the acts was determined by the States General. The States General determined the final form of the acts with the intention of sending copies to the rulers of all the foreign powers who had sent delegations. So this isn't a bit, it's kind of a propaganda thing that they're going to send out. Something promoting their unity of the United Nations, the United States of the Netherlands, with these other nations. That was the point of the acts. So they left out things that were only had to do with the Dutch interests, and they emphasized in those acts to these various rulers how important, how valuable their foreign delegates were and how they had contributed to the work at Dort. Recall that the truce with Spain was about to end, and they were sure hoping that these reformed people around Europe would stand with them in their battle against Spain. So a summary of the States General's involvement in the Synod of Dort. First of all, they controlled the remonstrant. This is very important. They summoned the particular remonstrants, and the remonstrants, if they didn't do what the Synod told them to do, which had the approval of the States General, they would be in rebellion to the States General. And that had some power. That had some threat to it. They enforced the deposition and exile of the remonstrants after the Synod was over. They financed the foreign delegates, enabling them to stay for months to condemn Arminianism and draw up a confession that sets forth the truth of sovereign grace. We wouldn't want the government to be over the church. That's not the proper relationship. Nonetheless, God clearly used that circumstance and used the States General to the advantage of the Synod of Dort. So God's purposes were fulfilled.